From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is day two of public impeachment hearings on Capitol Hill. This morning has been dramatic. Today's sole witness is Marie Yovanovitch, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. She is a career Foreign Service officer who was fired in April as the Trump administration tried to get Ukraine to investigate President Trump's political rival, Joe Biden. Today, she told the House Intelligence Committee she was the victim of a smear campaign. And as she was speaking, President Trump disparaged her, tweeting that everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad. Democratic Chairman Adam Schiff asked her to respond.
Well, I don't think I have such powers, not in Mogadishu, Somalia, and not in other places. I actually think that where I've served over the years, I and others have demonstrably made things better.
Joining us now is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, who's been watching the hearings today. Michelle, that was an extraordinary moment that unfolded in real time. Walk us through what happened there and what the response has been.
Well, the Republicans are trying to downplay this, you know, that a tweet could be that important. But the Democrats see this as a sign of witness intimidation. I mean, you have to remember that Yovanovitch went through what she's described as a campaign of disinformation, and that's why she was ousted. And it was interesting, Jeremy, because her opening statement, she really went through her background as a way to show that diplomats aren't just going to cocktail parties. They're the tip of the spear, as she called them, and important in national security interests. So she talked about how her first tour was in Mogadishu, Somalia. She talked about serving in Moscow during the 1993 attempted coup in Russia, caught in some crossfire. She talked about how her time in Ukraine, that she went to the front lines 10 times during the war in the East to show that the U.S. is supporting Ukraine and to see how U.S. aid was being put to use there.
And she said she felt shocked and devastated when President Trump disparaged her in that July phone call with Ukraine's president. How is her testimony coming across?
Well, I mean, she's pretty dramatic in retelling it. I mean, and very credible, I should say. She talked about how, you know, she knew that there was this campaign against her led by Trump's private lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. She doesn't know why, what his interests were, though she's learning more about that in real time. But she also said that when she didn't know until she read that call transcript, it was a July call, but it didn't come out until September, that, you know, the president was talking to the new Ukrainian president and saying that Yovanovitch was bad news and that she was going to go through some things. And she said that one of her friends who was watching her read it said that she turned white as she was looking at this and that she really felt very threatened by it.
Does she have anything more to offer about what the Democrats are trying to prove in this impeachment inquiry, which is that President Trump abused his power by asking Ukraine to investigate a political rival?
Well, you know, she wasn't there during the time when the U.S. aid was held up. So she's not talking about that part of it. But the Democrats do seem to be using this case, her ouster, as an abuse of power in and of itself. You know, all ambassadors serve at the pleasure of the president. She said that again in her testimony. But she also said that it's difficult to understand that foreign and private interests were able to undermine her and U.S. interests in that way. You know, she was, as I said, she was the target of a lot of disinformation, false rumors about her that seemed to be coming from corrupt Ukrainians to Rudy Giuliani, the private lawyer, and then made it on its way to Fox News and into conservative media, into President Trump's Twitter account and into his son's Twitter account.
Let's listen to the ranking Republican member of the committee, Devin Nunes. In his opening statement today, he said Democrats are just trying to topple a president they don't like.
In fact, Democrats have been vowing to oust President Trump since the day he was elected. So Americans can rightly suspect that his phone call with President Zelensky was used as an excuse for the Democrats to fulfill their Watergate fantasies.
Now, Nunes turned over most of his questioning time to the outside counsel for the Republicans today. What has been the Republican strategy in this hearing?
Well, I mean, first of all, I should say that, you know, Yovanovitch and the others that have come before her are public servants that serve both Democrats and Republicans, and that they were carrying out the stated U.S. policy. They've also backed President Trump's foreign policy, the stated one, I should say. So, for instance, the Republicans were just questioning her about Trump's decision to sell Javelin anti-tank missiles to Ukraine. It's something the Obama administration did not do. Yovanovitch, Bill Taylor, the current acting ambassador, all supported that idea and supported what President Trump was doing as the stated goals, which was supporting Ukraine and pushing back from Russian aggression. The questions are about this, you know, side, the shadow diplomacy going on with Rudy Giuliani and others.
As we've been listening to the hearing today, there was some other big news, which is that the former advisor to President Trump, Roger Stone, was found guilty in his trial of witness tampering and lying to Congress. That's big news all by itself, Michelle.
Right. And it does kind of fit in with this, because the other thing that the Trump administration has tried to do was to kind of shift the blame from Russia to Ukraine in 2016 election meddling. This case against Roger Stone grew out of the Robert Mueller investigation, and Stone was found guilty on all counts, including obstruction, witness tampering, and lying to Congress. And, you know, this was about his contacts with WikiLeaks, which published emails by Clinton aides during the 2016 campaign.
It all comes at the same time. I guess when the news rains, it pours. Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent, as we continue to follow the events on Capitol Hill, where former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, has been testifying in the impeachment inquiry before the House Intelligence Committee. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And as Jeremy said, we will continue to follow that story throughout the day. But let's take a minute to get an update on yesterday's deadly school shooting here in Southern California. Saugus High School in Santa Clarita is closed today as the community grieves. A teenage girl and boy were killed, and three others were wounded after a fellow student opened fire early yesterday morning before turning the gun on himself. Police say he was taken to the hospital in critical condition. Joining us now is KPCC's Kyle Stokes. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Tanya.
I can hear that you're out in Santa Clarita. Tell us more about how people are doing. We know that there were vigils last night, and there are more planned this weekend. And you were able to speak to parents and students as they reunited yesterday.
Yes, so I'm standing in the place where those reunifications took place. It's this large park called Central Park, which is nearby to the school. And this is where students were bused after they were evacuated from the campus and reunited with their parents. It was a scene, very orderly scene, but obviously a lot of parents were anxious to put hands back on their children again after a really, you know, sort of traumatic experience here. There's no visible signs that this place was the scene of these emotional reunifications, but there is one flagpole where there have been balloons tied to a little railing around the flagpole, prayer candles, flowers, a teddy bear lying here. Not a lot of people here around it, but one visible reminder that all is not normal in this community.
Yeah. Police have not shared the shooter's name, but they did say that yesterday when he carried out the shooting, it was his 16th birthday. What else do we know about him?
That is really as much as we know about the shooter and his identity. We have heard a little bit about the fact that there was a threat, according to sheriff's investigators, that was posted to an Instagram account tied to the shooter. We don't know whether that's the shooter making the threat. It's possible that the account may have been hacked. You know, investigators can't rule that out. But investigators don't have much as to the motive. And they still haven't released the shooter's name.
So many of us were watching on television the scenes where armed guards were taking out students from the school. And so many of the students seemed so calm and collected. How did these students respond to all of this in terms of being prepared for something as horrific as a shooting?
Well, I think a lot of the students and parents that I talked to said that this is the last thing they expected to happen in their community, in a community that they perceived as safe. And we hear that so often in these instances of on-campus gun incidents with schools. But it was also clear, talking to a lot of the students and parents yesterday, that they knew exactly what to do. One student described, barricading herself in the classroom, using a computer cart, shoving it against the door. Another student, took a fire extinguisher out of the hallway and, to use as a potential weapon for self-defense. His dad told me that he texted with his son. His son said, "I'm turning off my ringer now. I don't want to be able to tip off the shooter that anyone's in here." And so I think it's clear that the students, while it was the last thing they expected to happen at their school, it was something that they, once it did happen, they did know what to do.
Well, I know that you'll be following this throughout the day. I appreciate your time in this. Kyle Stokes is an education reporter for KPCC. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks, Tanya.
Well, Amtrak is on pace to break even for the first time in the railroad's nearly 50-year history. Ridership is at record highs. Revenue is up. And a company that's known more for losing money than making money appears to be on the cusp of a turnaround. Amtrak's president and chief executive, Richard Anderson, joins us now. He's also the former CEO of Delta Airlines. Richard Anderson, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
So these are good headlines, record ridership and losses well below your target. You're headed to the break-even point, though we should note that doesn't include money spent on maintaining some of Amtrak's physical infrastructure. But what's your takeaway from these numbers?
Well, the numbers are good numbers, and I think they're a reflection on the good employees at Amtrak who take their mission and the statutory obligations that we have at Amtrak very seriously. We did improve to the best operating performance in history. We had an operating loss, which essentially excludes non-cash depreciation. Our operating loss was $29.8 million, which was an 82% improvement over last year. And I think over the past 5 years, we've reduced the operating loss close to $400 million. So where we want to be as America's Railroad is to cover all of our operating costs through our revenues and then use the grant that we receive from our owners, the United States government, to invest in the infrastructure, the rail infrastructure across America.
Could Amtrak ever be profitable, do you think?
It's difficult for it to be profitable given that we have such a backlog of infrastructure investment. The Hudson Tunnels, the Portal Bridge, there's just not been real investment in rail in America or a sufficient investment in Amtrak so that to get to a state of good repair has, we probably have a $30 to $40 billion backlog like much of the infrastructure in our country.
Well, a lot of the gains in ridership that you saw came from the Northeast corridor of Amtrak, especially the Washington, D.C. To Boston route. Meanwhile, the long-distance route saw a much smaller increase in ridership. You have said you wanted to prioritize these urban corridors over the cross-country routes. Do you think that that is happening and fast as you'd like?
It's not happening as fast as we would like or as fast as the country needs it, because what we do see at Amtrak is in those routes where highways have reached such a congestion point, Amtrak grows significantly. That would be San Diego to L.A., Milwaukee to Chicago, and, of course, any of the many, many stops on the corridor, and we define the corridor pretty broadly from Richmond, Virginia, all the way up to Maine. All of the I-95 corridor is now so congested that every community along that corridor wants a rail stop.
Well, is there anything that's ever going to stop that? Because that's always going to be the case, right? If you're going to take the train through a place, they're going to want you to stop there, which makes it slower for everybody else.
Well, but that's where product differentiation is really important. And that's where you see us moving at Amtrak with the Acela nonstop. And, you know, this idea was not invented at Amtrak. We see it in Europe. We see it in Asia, in much more developed, well-operated passenger rail systems, which is the same track system can have multiple product offerings, a nonstop Acela from Boston to New York, a regular Acela that has a handful of stops, the Northeast Regional that stops at almost every station. And then ultimately, we want to be in a position as we acquire new European-style train set equipment to opening virtually every station that we can up and down the corridor so that we basically have four products in the marketplace that are differentiated offerings and have, you know, different price points, but provide maximum level of services to the maximum number of people in the corridor.
You were the CEO of Delta before coming to Amtrak. And as we know, when you get on a plane, the first thing that the pilot says is, you know, safety is our number one concern. I know that you've made safety a very important part of your time at Amtrak and safety improvements. There have been some high profile train crashes. How is that going at this point?
You know, that is the most important thing. It's more important than the financial results. And, you know, we have made tremendous progress. We're the first railroad in America to implement a safety management system, which is modeled after aviation. I was fortunate enough to be able to recruit probably the leading safety executive from aviation, Ken Highlander. And we installed an SMS. We put in through that SMS a safety metric system, an internal evaluation program, risk reduction program, and importantly, the use of data to determine how we're performing. I'm pleased to report that in the last year, we had no employee or customer fatalities in our last fiscal year, no NTSB accidents. Our customer incident rate was down 26%. We had a 72% reduction in serious employee injuries. And our FRA, reportable injuries for employee injuries, was down 10%. Hmm. So on virtually all of our metrics, we have sustained really strong performance. Most importantly, we have accomplished the installation of positive train control. And that is a really big event for Amtrak.
That's been one of the things that every time there has been one of the train crashes, people have been talking about positive train control, which is kind of an automated system, right, to make sure that the train doesn't go too fast around corners and things like that.
Precisely. You described it perfectly.
What is the biggest challenge facing Amtrak this next fiscal year?
Two big challenges. One is we pretty much operate on host railroads. That's freight railroads. And the freight railroads do not run us on time. And that's really a challenge for a business that sells reliability and sells saving time. And we have a number of efforts underway. But bottom line is we have to have enforcement of the statutory obligation that was created in 1970 when Amtrak took over responsibility for intercity passenger transportation on rail. We were given a preference over freight train traffic to run on time, and that has been by and large ignored. So number one, in order for us to be a reliable service provider to people all over the country, we have to be able to run on time. And then number two is, as we think about the future of surface transportation in America, it's getting the flexibility both from a funding perspective and from a design perspective to be able to put in new services that will meet the demand for our services in dense urban corridors. And right now, between a complex legal structure under Section 209 and 212 of PREA, which is the statute we operate under, we're constrained. And we need thought leadership in Congress. We need thought leadership in DOT. We need thought leaderships in the state governments to help us plot what we want the future of rail to be. You know, in Boston, you know, in New York, you know, in Washington, D.C., the critical role that rail plays in dense urban areas. Mm-hmm. We are only going to have more road congestion. The interstate highway system is not going to be able to be expanded, and we can't afford to expand it, really. And our population between now and 2050 is projected to grow somewhere between 75 to 100 million people. We can't put all those cars on the road, and Amtrak is the best environmental answer. Our biggest challenge is I go testify in Congress, and all we talk about is French toast on dining cars or food. We aren't talking about the really big infrastructure issues and transportation congestion issues that all the people in this country want a solution for.
That is Richard Anderson, the president and CEO of Amtrak. We talked about a lot more, including competition from private rail. We'll bring that conversation to you soon.
Germany is struggling to contain the rise of a far-right extremist violence. This week, a member of the right-wing AfD party was stripped of his leadership role in parliament for making anti-Semitic comments. And late last month, the government proposed new rules that would restrict gun purchases and force social media companies to remove and report hate speech. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd was in Berlin recently and spoke with Franziska Brantner. She's a member of parliament and the center-left Green Party. They'd met to talk about Brexit. But Peter also asked her if the proposed domestic terrorism rules went far enough.
Finally, we believe it's far too late and it's too little. We believe that we have to have stricter regulations still in the social media. We need more transparency. We need more responsibility. And we also need to have more clarity when it comes to the far right networks within our own security services, the police, the army, etc. So there we believe more needs to be done.
You know, it's interesting. The nationalist movement in this country is very much a kind of a mirror image in some ways of what tipped the United Kingdom towards Brexit. What do you make of the rise of the far right across Europe?
I think, to be honest, that the Brexiteers in the UK are not all racist. But you have, of course, part of that Brexit movement is a nationalist movement of going out. But it's not necessarily entirely a racist movement. And the far right in Germany is racist. They're also nationalists, but above all, they're racist. But I think that we have to, on the one side, address the socioeconomic reasons, if they exist, behind the grievances. And on the other side, to start having very open discussions and honest discussions about the fears laying behind the cultural war. These are some of the same as you have in the US or in other countries, this sort of fear, oh, am I going to be in a minority in the future? I've always been part of the majority, and now what comes next? There's this fear because everybody remembers how badly the majority treated the minority in the past. You know, if I speak to people and then they say, yeah, but, you know, I remember how terribly we treated the one black guy in the class and how we terribly treated the one Turkish guy in our class. And I'm afraid my kid is going to be treated the same way in the class. And then you can start another discussion. But it's that, you know, going to the real fears, talking about them and trying, you know, on the other side to say this is no excuse for being racist.
I'm taking a look at how the rise of your party over the last couple of months, year or so in Germany, doing quite well in elections, and also the rise of some far-right parties, the AfD. What do you make of that those two things are happening simultaneously?
You know, we have been putting so much effort in building bridges and going out of the polarization. And it's quite interesting because, of course, when you look just from tactical purposes, for us, it would often pay off to go into more polarization. But we don't do it because we fundamentally believe it will not help society. We have to start building bridges, go away from polarization. So I also sometimes believe that our good election results are a recompensation for building those bridges.
That was German MP Franziska Brantner of the Green Party speaking with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd in Berlin.
Russia said this week that it has set up a new airbase in a city in northern Syria abandoned by U.S. forces when Turkey invaded last month. That invasion was done by order of the Turkish president, but there's reporting that many of the fighters, both from Turkey and Russia, were actually mercenaries, outside contractors. The U.S. has also relied on mercenaries in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Sean McFate has worked as a private military contractor. He's also a former army officer. And he writes about the use of contractors in his book, The New Rules of War. Sean, welcome to Here and Now.
It's great to be with you.
Well, and first of all, let's define our terms here. Explain what the difference between a mercenary and a military contractor is, or is there a difference?
Well, volumes of ink by experts have been spilt on this topic, but the bottom line is there's really not much of a difference. If you can be one, you can be the other, and it really comes down to labels.
And which countries are using them right now?
Well, the U.S. used them heavily in Iraq and Afghanistan. Right now, they're being used heavily by Russia and the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
And why?
There's a lot of reasons why people would hire mercenaries. One, the main reason is that they give you plausible deniability. So modern warfare is getting sneakier. It's not about who has more F-35s or aircraft carriers. It's about sneakiness. And so special forces, mercenaries, little green men, propaganda, this is what turns the tide of war now. And mercenaries are extremely good at giving plausible deniability.
And why do you want that?
Because we live in a global information age. And in a global information age, plausible deniability eclipses firepower. Look at how Russia took Ukraine. In sort of the old ways of war, they would have marched in with tanks like they did in Hungary and Czechoslovakia during the Cold War. In the new way of war, they used these tools of plausible deniability to have a ghost occupation. So it's a fait accompli by the time the first tank shows up. And mercenaries, again, like the Wagner Group, which is a Russian mercenary group, they're being used everywhere in the Middle East and Africa now, not just Ukraine, and rumored to be in Venezuela too.
So they can just say, if something goes wrong, oh, well, that wasn't us. That was these other people. We have nothing to do with them.
That's right, even though the intelligence community has a pretty good idea it was them. But here's an example. I mean, first of all, mercenaries, we think of mercenaries as these like cartoonish villains from Hollywood. That's not who they are these days. They are pretty sophisticated. So in February of 2018, the Russian mercenary group, the Wagner Group, had 500 mercenaries go up against some of our best troops in aviation in eastern Syria. It was a secret battle. And our troops were Delta Force, Rangers, Green Berets, and they called in B-52s, F-15s, AC-130 gunships, Apache helicopters, drones, you name it, to fight off these 500 mercenaries. Now, they wiped out the mercenaries, but it took them 4 hours to do that. And the military is touting that as a big win, but it's really not. Because what happens if you're facing 5,000 mercenaries? It's not Delta Force. It's one of the National Guard units, as we had many in Iraq before. So mercenaries are pretty sophisticated and pretty lethal these days.
And are most of them like you, former Army people, came out of the official military and then decided to become a contractor afterwards?
Yeah, almost all of them are. So I spent several years in the industry, and I got out when I realized that there were no old people in my industry. Mm-hmm. The way that the mercenary world is organized, it's sort of an illicit economy, so it's organized around language groups. The big ones are Russian speakers, English speakers, and Spanish speakers. There's some others like French speakers too, but those are the three big ones, and they all come from usually some version of special forces or something like that. Sometimes national police units or paramilitary units, but they all come from someplace. There's no organic basic training for mercenaries.
Now, let's talk about the United States. You've reported that during World War II, 10% of America's armed forces were contractors. That was up to 50% in Iraq and Afghanistan. What about today with the U.S. and contractors?
Yeah, so the U.S. has pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan, but still there's a huge footprint of contractors. So in Afghanistan today, there's a 3-to-1 ratio of contractors to troops, but only a fraction of those are armed contractors. I mean, most contractors are just making food or repairing vehicles, but about 2,000 or 3,000 are armed or trigger pullers. And this is sort of what prompted or resurrected the mercenary trade, which is, let's face it, it's the second oldest profession, but it went underground for a couple hundred years, and now it's raging back to life.
And when we think about the negative headlines when it comes to the U.S. and contractors, employees of the private security firm Blackwater were convicted for civilian deaths in the Iraq War. What would you say are the biggest drawbacks of using mercenaries for any country?
Well, there's quite a few drawbacks. One, it's a way to circumvent democratic accountability of the armed forces because the White House doesn't really have to report them. It's a way also to lower the barriers of entry to war. So, for example, the reason we ended up with so many contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan is that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were not short wars, contrary to the promises of Rumsfeld and other neocons. And we either had to sort of leave Iraq and Afghanistan and concede defeat. We'd have to have a Vietnam-like draft to fill an all-volunteer force that didn't want to volunteer. Or we use contractors. And so using contractors allows you to sort of go to war without having to have your own people bleed. And that creates problems.
They also probably change the nature of the conflict that they're fighting in just by being there.
That's right. So mercenaries commodify warfare and make it a market activity. So where supply and demand are now strategies that replace traditional ways of warfare. And when mercenaries come into a place like the Middle East or Africa, these are continents in conflict, profit motive demands that they start or elongate wars for profit. And a world awash in mercenaries is a world with more conflict and suffering.
Now, you worked as a mercenary until around 2007. You've said you got out of it after being asked to do morally questionable things. Do you think mercenaries are asked to do things that they shouldn't be?
They do, but and so are soldiers. I mean, I would like to make a distinction here. Well, first of all, it's amusing that people in the industry, they call themselves private military contractors, not mercenaries, but it's a bit of a euphemism. Mercenaries can make they have moral choices they can engage in. And when I was in the industry, there's all sorts of reasons why people would join the industry. Some do it for money, some do it for adventurism, some do it because they want to kill people, to be frank about it. But there are other reasons, too, they do it. They do it because they're curious. They do it because they're soldiers who come back and they don't want to be a UPS truck driver anymore. And they want to and they go back to places like Iraq to help the Peshmerga go after ISIS. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why people do it. And at some of us find that there are moral litmus tests. And for me, it was time to get out when I was asked to question my loyalty essentially to the United States of America, and I was unwilling to do that.
When you look at the conflict now in northern Syria, and it has calmed down somewhat, but the idea that you have mercenaries doing the battle for various countries there, what do you think that means?
I think that Syria is a case study of modern warfare. Modern warfare is a form of shadow warfare. It's all under the table, and if you see it bubble up, then you know it's reached a crisis point. I think we have a lot of warriors in places like Syria now, Libya, the Congo, and we don't know who they represent. They're all masked, and we don't know who they fight for. And it's not just governments; they could fight for, you know, oil companies,
right,
or oligarchs or even mega churches. We
you
don't
think
know
that they are doing that, or are you just making that as hypothetical?
It's a hypothetical, but based on some of my own background, I didn't always work for the U.S. government as a contractor. And I saw things in the field that the extractive industry, for example, even some NGOs are looking increasingly at private forces, mostly for defensive purposes, unlike the Wagner Group, which are offensive. But that has been a moving goalpost for the last 20 years. And I believe I would not be surprised if we saw, for example, a mega church or a movie star do a humanitarian intervention in a place like Syria or northern Iraq should ISIS 2.0, you know, rear its head again.
That is Sean McFate, who is a former Army officer and former private military contractor, author of The New Rules of War. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Louisiana voters go to the polls this weekend to finally elect a governor. This is a runoff between the incumbent Democrat John Bel Edwards and Republican businessman Eddie Rasponi. The race is tight, and President Trump is watching closely. He was actually in the state on Thursday, urging Louisiana voters to elect the Republican candidate. Trump also linked the ongoing impeachment inquiry to the state's election. For more, we're joined by Paul Braun, state politics reporter for member station WRKF in Baton Rouge. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So John Bel Edwards, he's been governor since 2016, and he's trying to hang on to his seat. Here he is speaking in the gubernatorial debate.
And I get along well with presidents of both parties. I've done that with President Obama and with President Trump. 9 times I've met with the president to discuss things like infrastructure, opioid epidemic, and criminal justice reform.
He's considered a prime GOP target, and he's also pretty moderate, right?
That's right. He has to be in a state like Louisiana, not just in election years, but in office as well. So to get anything done, he's got to do it with bipartisan support. A quick couple of examples. He passed major criminal justice reform in his first term, and he raised taxes with a budget shortfall, which he gets hit pretty hard for on the campaign trail. But he's quick to remind voters that 2/3 of the Republican-controlled legislature voted for that. He's staunchly pro-gun, and back in May, he signed into law one of the strictest abortion restrictions in the country that would prohibit abortions as early as 6 weeks.
There's a lot of money pouring in from Republicans as well, though. The Republican National Committee has spent about $2 million and deployed 60 paid staffers to try to unseat Edwards. Tell us more about the guy they're pulling for and putting all of their money behind.
His name's Eddie Rasponi. He's never held political office, but it's also important to note that Rasponi has loaned his campaign $12 million of his own money and has been really sort of bootstrapping his campaign with his own finances since the beginning.
Yeah, and Rasponi has been making this race all about Trump. Here are his first words from the debate.
I think the thing that I see is that I'm a supporter of Trump, and what Trump has done for our country has been phenomenal. You know, we have a Democratic Party that's going after impeachment, which is sidetracking everything that we're trying to do on a national level.
We know Trump was there for a second time yesterday for a rally. What has been his impact on this race so far?
I think it'd be fair to say that from Rasponi's perspective, Trump is the race. His first introduction to voters was in a campaign ad where he sat on the tailgate of his truck pointing to a Trump bumper sticker. He has been kind of quiet on specific policies that he'd enact as governor. So he's pretty much entirely linked his campaign to President Trump and his popularity in the state.
You know, it's a lot of people say it's not fair, really, to say that the governor's races are bellwethers of the president's support because they really are so specific to each state. Edwards has been a Democratic governor in a very red state, as you said. But is this different, though, because the president has put so much energy into this campaign, do you think?
It's hard to say. Louisiana has been trending Republican for a while now. Governor Edwards is the only Democratic governor in the Deep South. But his 2015 election was based very largely on politics and the characters who were running. Now, with a lot of experience under his belt, Edwards is campaigning for a second term. And I think this would be a pretty good indicator of, you know, how far partisan politics have seeped into Louisiana local politics if Edwards were to lose his bid for reelection.
Yeah. Here's Trump on one of his visits to the state last week in Monroe.
And soon the people of Louisiana will head to the polls. You know, I'm really here for a little different reason. It's called early voting. You believe it? That's how much I like Eddie.
Tell us a little bit about early voting. What have we seen so far from turnout there?
Early voting has been a big focus for the Edwards campaign in particular, since they had relatively poor showing in the primary. In early voting this go-around, 31% of early voters in early voting of the runoff were African-American. That's an increase from 25% total from the first round of voting in October. That is a huge demographic for Edwards. Mm-hmm. And if he can do well there, his chances of winning re-election are quite good. But turnout is key.
Going back to the start of our conversation, given Edwards' record as a moderate and the fact that Louisiana state legislature is dominated by Republicans, I'm just wondering if a change in leadership would make a real difference in the lives of Louisiana residents. Or is this race just important because it's become a national ideological battleground?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think people are quick to look to states where Republican supermajorities existed in the legislature and in the governor's office. Even if Edwards wins, the Republicans may gain you know, cross the threshold into having a supermajority in the legislature, which would be a first for Louisiana. And that could really take some of the teeth out of the governor's role, which has traditionally been a pretty strong role in Louisiana politics.
That's Paul Braun, WRKF state politics reporter. Thank you again.
Thanks so much.